It is Wednesday, April 24th, a little bit after 5 p.m. You know what that means. It's time for Tasty Live's all-new evening show, The Price of Truth, a little podcast where we like to explore the incentives that govern our world, the ideas to have guests come on, great guests with great minds come on, share great ideas. Today is no different, as we're going to start to do for the month of May through April is, Wednesdays are going to be Ilya Spivak days. Ilya, welcome back to The Price of Truth. How you doing, my friend?
Good. All this talk about great minds, I'm not sure what I'm doing here, but all right. I'll take it.
You're a gentleman and a scholar. My friend, before we get into today's market action, what'd you think about robo-taxis yesterday? I had a nice little conversation with Chris. I know, you know, you're not always in the weeds about some of the stuff, but every once in a while, you've been doing some deep study on things I never would have guessed. What's your take on the whole Tesla issue from yesterday and their price action? More importantly, the future of robo-taxis.
I mean, I think kind of broadly speaking, in the sort of great scheme of things, I get a little bit of a privileged view on robo-taxis because I'm in San Francisco. And we see this all the time, kind of every day, because we have driverless cars all over the city at this point. And there was definitely some backlash around, I mean, the Waymo ones seem to be doing okay, but there was definitely some backlash where there were accidents, they were not seeing pedestrians, they were getting stuck at corners. That was probably the most annoying one, where you'd get two of them at a corner and one edge is out, the other edge is out, and they're not sure which one's going to go, and then there's deadlock. So I think what that speaks to is the idea that people are going to need to see more here before there is confident adoption. And until there is confident adoption, this isn't really a thing that's going to be anybody's revenue stream of substance, be it Tesla or anyone else. It sort of echoes crypto to me, in the sense that, like, the problem with crypto always from the inception was that it was really volatile, and it was really volatile because it wasn't liquid. And the only way to get it liquid was to get more people to believe, but the only way to get people to believe is to make it less volatile. And so it was this kind of doom loop where, to get people to go, yes, I buy into this idea, you had to get it liquid enough to not be so jumpy. But you needed people to stomach that, and they didn't at a mass adoption kind of level. I think you're going to need more confidence building here before this is something where people other than, those of us that would willingly chip themselves, I am not one of those, where they would go, yes, I will get into a robo-taxi. I think before you scale that to something that looks like real money on a corporate balance sheet, you're going to need to do better. And that's going to be a while.
Yeah, I think I agree with you 100%. I think I heard Gene Musk say something when I was listening to it late last night, or my last night, after the show yesterday, where he effectively said, even if you get the car out in a year, you still got to get approvals, which means this isn't any element of revenue, best case scenario, until 2 years out. And that's effectively what you're playing. And if it's 2 years out, it impacts price potentially. If it's 3 years out, it probably goes nowhere for a long time. Let's talk about market action today, because the market is, as you like to say, and many others, it's always, what have you done for me lately? They're heavy, my friend.
They are heavy.
A lot of that has to do with Facebook's earnings announcement.
They didn't like it.
You know, the irony, and I reposted this on Twitter, formerly Twitter, X now. I always get that mixed up. I'm not calling it Twitter, or excuse me, X. But yesterday you get Tesla, who completely basically pukes all over their earnings expectations. They rally 15% from 144 to 160. Today you get Meta that blows their numbers away. And now they're down 15% after hours. What's your take? We'll talk about Facebook here or Meta in just a second, but just what was your take on market action today? Broadly speaking, equities.
I thought the market action made very good sense. In fact, I was actually talking with Chris about this on our show Overtime before today's session. So talking about it on Tuesday. And I said, look, I would not be surprised. In fact, I think the way that Wednesday is going to work is we're going to open higher. It's going to be generally positive in the first half of the day. And in the second half, we're going to fade. And it's going to get dicey. And the reason it's going to get dicey is because the market could care less about these earnings. It's not about earnings. It's a conversation that is existing. And by the way, I mean, obviously, we're not saying that individual names don't care about earnings. I mean, obviously, look at what happened with Meta stock after they released. Like, people do care. Let's not confuse things. But at a macro kind of market-wide NASDAQ level, S&P level, I don't think it's these earnings that matter most. I think it's actually a higher level consideration. It's a bigger picture. Before you want to decide, you know what, I'm going to buy or not buy Tesla, I'm going to buy or not buy Meta, or gold, or crude, or whatever, you have to decide whether you want to put money at risk at all on anything, or whether you want to be defensive. And much of the conversation about whether markets want to put money at risk, for me, going all the way back to late October, early November, has been about the idea that the Fed is going to make money cheaper in the future. And so if you lose money when you put it at risk, you can borrow it back cheaper and go again. So for me this week, the key event is GDP. That's tomorrow. So my thought was the markets are going to get through half the day on Wednesday and say, right, so we have this big event risk coming up tomorrow. Let's pump the brakes here. Let's back up. Let's get into a kind of defensive crouch while we wait for this data to come out. Obviously, Meta earnings are a big sort of thing. And Chris was hypothesizing on our show today that it's the way they guided for the second quarter that's the reason for this sell-off.
Of course.
I am no individual stock analyst. I don't profess to be one. So I don't, it sounds right to me that take. But I think also when you look at this and you say, here was a big piece of event risk that the markets needed to get on the other side of to do what they were going to do. They got on the other side and they sold off because what they wanted to do was sell off, because what they wanted to do was get defensive ahead of a GDP number that might make rate cuts look like they're not coming, or at least might endorse this idea that we're not getting three or two, we're getting one, maybe. And that this is going to be bad news for risk taking as a whole.
Let me pick at this idea, because a lot of the conversations this year have been guided around cuts or no cuts, three cuts, six cuts, three cuts, two cuts, one cut, no cuts, a hike. I understand how. Help me understand how you're thinking about that from an equity perspective, because I can make a case that stocks should do X, Y, or Z in all of those scenarios. They should go up, yes, or they should go down in all those scenarios. I'll give you an example. If you're talking about hikes into the future, you're talking about an economy, and you're talking about You're talking about corporations that were able to, are still able to pass their pricing power onto consumers. And they're going to continue to do that, which means increased corporate profits. And there's a case where if you, they're cutting, good in theory, for future cost of capital, but it also means that the Fed is trying to get ahead of a slowdown in the economy, which then means less future revenues. So to me, I go, all of this cut shit is noise. I'm not going to pay attention to it. Whether it's a hike, they stay, or they end up cutting once or twice, to me, I got to throw all that bullshit out and just focus on what I want to do with risk, whether it's short-term, medium-term, or long-term, because all of that stuff is going to be just noise. Most of it is narrative anyway. When we came into the year, Ilya, you and I
talked, disagree, obviously.
I'm gonna open this up. I thought 0% chance the market is pricing this correctly. Even when they got to three, I thought 0% chance. I think there's a chance that they cut once to open up the range and see what happens. But other than that, I don't think anybody knows, including them. What do you think about what I just said, how to position, whether or not people should care and put so much emphasis on one or two cuts, and whether that's the fulcrum for whether they should be taking risk or not?
So here's the problem with all of that. You can always spin any narrative about anything. And so the way that I look, and so the way that I look at macro is not from that perspective as a general consideration. I look at the price action because what I want is for the market to tell me what it cares about. So for me, it's not about whether I can rationalize that rate cuts are good or rate cuts are bad, because I can rationalize both sides.
Okay.
It's how is the market responding?
And what is it responding to? Isn't that always going to be backward looking?
Well, everything is always backward looking
for the market to tell. Well, that's the difference between reacting to price action or thinking, okay, this is what the market, this is how the market is responding. Aren't you always in a position where you're sort of a little bit behind the curve?
Not at all. What you're doing is you're letting the market reveal to you the lens through which it looks at things. You're letting the market tell you, I care about this, I don't care about that. And so I like to, in a bit of a cheeky way perhaps, call this the does the market care about Italian elections indicator. Because every few years there is some upheaval in Italy and there's a government collapse. And sometimes the markets go, oh my God, it's an Italian government collapse. And sometimes they go, eh, it's an Italian government collapse. This happens often enough. And the difference where they care or where they don't is, do they want to take risk or do they not care that there is a risk because they think they can paper over that risk, and even if they lose money, it won't matter. So you can even have the same exact event occur and markets can care or not care. This is why looking at the price action and how different markets, especially in conjunction, respond, can tell you what the markets care about. And it can be very different, and they can care or not care about the same thing depending on atmospherics. So for me, I look at the NASDAQ chart here is perfect. Where is the bottom on this chart? And where is the Fed meeting on November the 1st, where they say we are done raising rates, the next move is going to be a cut? It's at the bottom of this rally, pretty much exactly at the bottom of this rally. Where is the top in this rally? It's March the 21st, the day after the Fed says we're still looking at three cuts, literally the next day. So how do you then look at this rally? Well, if you look at the way this has evolved, and this is a chart that I've been putting up on macro money for like 4 or 5 months now. What you see is the Fed comes out on November the 1st and says, rate cuts, everyone. We're done hiking. Market goes, oh, great. You start a rally. Fed doesn't quantify how many cuts they're thinking about until late December, which is the next meeting where they update their official summary of economic projections. So the markets go wild. They go out to 6 cuts. Then there's a Fed meeting. It's late. Christmas is like 2 days later. By that point, nobody's paying attention. So we get into the beginning of January with 6 cuts, which I completely agree with you, sounds bananas. And the economic data starts coming in and the markets go, okay, data's better. Some of it is surprising on the upside. Okay, jobs is surprising on the upside. Okay, inflation is showing up hotter. All right, let's start to chip away at these cuts. And we go from 6 to 5 to 4 to 3. But the entire time, we are more cuts than the Fed is saying until we get to less. And the day that we get to less, the day that the outlook for the year, as it is baked into Fed funds futures, is 61 basis points and not 62, is the day the rally stops. What happens at 61 basis points? The probability of that third cut is less than 50%. So the markets flip and say, the Fed's wrong. Since then, we've had a wild sell-off, and what have the expectations done? They've gone to 33 basis points. That's one cut and some optionality limited on a second. In that time, we've had the breakout of two wars. We've had every which different piece that you could construct a narrative around. The AI boom, this or that. The markets have shrugged off everything until there is a change in the cost of money. Because what that defines is whether you want to take risk at all of any kind on anything. So I look at the price action and I say, well, clearly they care. Fast forward to this week. On Tuesday, we get a weak U.S. PMI number. Really weak. Much weaker than expected. 4-month low. The instant that data comes out, that second, the Fed outlook shifts to a more dovish setting by just 4 basis points. Stocks rally across the board, the dollar gets smashed, and that carries through until basically midday in today's session. Tesla happened in the interim. A bunch of other earnings came out in the interim. Nobody cares. The second that weak number came out and gave them 4 more basis points in cuts, just 4, they responded instantaneously. So I look at the price action, and I say, well, I don't need to spin narratives. I can just look at what the market is doing. The market's going to tell me what it cares about. That's all.
There's some part of me that still wants to challenge, not because I disagree with what you're saying, but because I like this thread we're pulling up. Let me give
challenge,
you...
Challenge, challenge. I love it.
Let me say... Okay, so let's say this. Bro, this rally was highly concentrated. You and I both know this. And I'm not disputing that obviously.
Of course it was. Yes. Liquidity I agree entirely.
I'm not disputing that there was a change in the Fed narrative. But man, the older I get, the more I believe those guys are just, you know, there's just a bunch of people I have no idea what's going on that are trying to spin a narrative like they're running shit, but they're not. The older I get, that's the impression I get about everything. It's the impression I get about our government, the Federal Reserve. All these people act like they have some sense of control or some sense of ultimate knowledge about the future, about where we are, and they don't know anything. So let me give you another part. not only did you have a supportive liquidity environment, as you're mentioning, but let's also say NVIDIA was adding $200 billion in market cap and on a one-day basis. And they were doing that, sure. Was there a supportive liquidity environment? Absolutely. But were they also adding billions in current and future expected revenues to their forecast? Absolutely. Did you have the same thing with Meta? Did they also, at the same time, while giving supportive current and future guidance until now, were they also adding? Were they also adding? You know, did they also make their stock very attractive for institutional investors by creating that dividend? Absolutely. Did they also start speaking to the street about cost cutting and get off this stupid metaverse thing where they're incinerating money? Absolutely. What I'm basically saying to you is, in the last 6 months ish, you've had a supportive liquidity environment, but I could also make the case for you, GDP has been well above trend. I can make the case to you that we've gone from up, 6-7% inflation all the way down to the 3%. Now we're getting sticky in terms of inflation. So there's, I would say that the Fed narrative has overlaid to a portion of the economy that also outperformed lower expectations. You've had disinflation during that entire period. I can make the case to you, what I'm basically saying is, I can give you a fundamental case for why this was a good risk-taking window that had nothing to do with what the Federal Reserve was doing. What? Okay. How do you respond to that?
Oh, emphatically. That's how I respond to it. So the idea that the Fed thinks themselves prescient or all-powerful, I think, is fundamentally not anything they would ever say, not anything they would ever claim, not anything they have suggested, certainly not in any iteration of the Fed, let's call it from Ben Bernanke onward, because that's where I've been listening to them personally and directly. Greenspan is a little bit before my time, and he was famously cryptic, and before Greenspan, I make no claims. But at least since Bernanke, the Fed would never even begin to suggest any kind of prescience or power or anything ever. So that's one thing, but that's neither here nor there. Even if they did, I don't care what the Fed thinks about themselves. I care about what drives asset markets, because I'm trying to make money trading. Whether the Fed thinks themselves powerful and they are, or they're not, or they don't think themselves powerful and they are or are not, is entirely irrelevant for me. What's relevant for me is, do the markets look at the Fed as powerful? Do they pay attention to what they're doing? Is it shaping the way that markets respond to news, to the price action? And what can I infer from that to see, okay, if they get news X, they might reply with response Y. That's it. I don't care what the Fed thinks about themselves, or whether they are powerful or aren't powerful, how they see themselves. Doesn't matter. So now, to the fundamental structure. Has the disinflation changed? No. Inflation hasn't gone anywhere in months. It's been basically static. Why did
Since
markets
January,
turn?
Sure.
Why did markets turn? Did GDP slow down in an untoward, below-trend way? No. Why did markets turn? Did we see anything about the AI narrative that has become less hopium that we believe? No. We were willing to believe the hopium before. We're not willing, apparently, to believe it now. Of course it was concentrated, because it was concentrated in the names where what the market was betting on was the great and bright potential future. We have no idea actually when this stuff is going to make money, when it can be scaled globally, when these hypothetical efficiency gains are going to maybe happen. We have no idea. But what we were willing to do as markets was to believe. Why were we willing to believe? Because taking a roll of the dice made sense if a loss could be borrowed back cheaper. And we no longer are willing to do that. Zuckerberg was out there saying, just so you guys know, it might be like to 2050 until we actually see any economic benefits to the scalability of AGI. Just in the past 24 hours, I've been saying it longer. Because even if we have the technology, let's say we have the great, we've invented Skynet, let's say. Okay? Before Skynet is scalable, we need to figure out how we're going to get enough cobalt, for one. How we're going to get enough inputs for all of this. We don't know how we're going to do that. No idea. We have no idea, even if we'd invented it, and we haven't. So the essence of all of this was always hope and excitement at the prospect, at the possibility. And people were willing to do that, other things be damned. Why? Because the liquidity environment was shaping up such that it made sense to take a flyer. And it doesn't anymore. If all of these things about GDP and disinflation and blah, 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 if all of that was the thing, we wouldn't have such a concentrated rally. We'd have a broad rally. Because what we would have is the tide that lifts all boats, a real upswell in fundamental strength in the economy. Did we have that? No. We had a concentrated rally in those names where you had to be amongst the faithful and extrapolate in your mind's eye that we're going to get to benign Skynet tomorrow. That's a liquidity environment as okay. A catalyst.
Let me pull in a stretch from a different direction. Yes. Well said, my friend. Let me pull in from a different direction. I'm 38 years old right now. I started.
You and I are very close.
Yeah, I started 41. When I was 20 years old, January of 2007. Mm-hmm. Perfect timing.
Yeah.
So, what I've never really seen this cost of capital. I've never really meaningfully traded through it. I might have, like, in the early days, I might have been throwing some money down on some call spreads here and there. But, like, I've never really meaningfully traded through this cost of capital. And I'm being humble about that.
Me too.
Not only have I never traded through that environment, I've never traded through inflation above 3%. And you know, I think Macro Alf has put out a lot of good stuff. And this was in a conversation we had with Jem Carson a really long time ago, that when you get higher levels of inflation, your stock bond correlations completely flip. They go positive. And we've sort of seen that. Stocks go up, yields go up. And people are sort of scratching their head because they remember in 2022 when yields go up and it demolishes stocks. Well, you've got a different environment now. I'm being super humble about the fact that I'm now trading in an environment I've never actually seen. I've only seen it in my data mining and my research and in textbooks. So let me ask the question a little bit differently. How is it that you are approaching markets today that is different than Ilya and Victor having a conversation in 2021 or in 2011 or in, you know, how are you approaching markets differently? How are you adjusting to signals in the market, or are you not at all?
Well, so this is really the essence of the way that I think about macro, which is what we were just talking about, is I am not trying to predict. What I'm trying to do is let the markets tell me what they care about. And the price action lens becomes absolutely critically important. Because what I need to understand isn't if the macro does this, you know, if inflation does this, then I'm looking for that. If the cost of capital shifts, if credit spreads do this and the liquidity environment looks this way versus that, how I need to respond. I don't need, in my view, to predict those things, nor is it possible. Because if you look historically, there's been all kinds of different periods. I mean, if you read Dalio's great book on the history of economic crises, if you look at Howard Marx's great book.
Which one? The debt cycles that you're talking about?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, if you look at Howard Marx's great book, Mastering the Market Cycle, which I think is actually superior because it's a little bit more concise, more clear, less kind of wandering in the way it's written. I like both. I've read Dalio's other book as well, Principles. So I like Dalio. I like his stuff. I think Howard Marx in sort of this conversation did a more effective job, in my opinion, for me, as like a hands-on thing. I'm reading a book now from the great Ron Chernow, the guy that wrote Hamilton, the guy that wrote the great biography on Ulysses S. Grant, about the history of the House of Morgan, J.P. Morgan, and all of the incredible tumult in U.S. financial history through that lens.
Is that the two-volume book, or is Neil Ferguson's the two?
I think Niall Ferguson is the two.
Neil.
Niall? I don't know. I don't know. English is my second language. I profess no great knowledge. As the great Sean Price famously said, I work so hard to be this stupid. So the market interrelationships change all the time. They wax, they wane, things change, different things echo into each other. So for me, the price action has to be where you jump off from. And so what I do is I look at the incoming flow of information, macro data, geopolitical developments, big picture stuff. And then I look at, okay, what are stocks doing? What's gold doing? What's crude oil doing? What are bonds and rates doing? What are the major G5, G10 currencies doing? And then I look for themes, but the themes have to come from the price action. I'm not attempting to sit there and go, well, if this happens, then this is going to happen, this is going to happen. Instead, I say, when this happened, stocks did this, and bonds did this, and rates did this, and currencies did this, and commodities did that. What world would we have to be living in where that would occur? And what does then that layout say about if we then got this piece of news here or that piece of news there, if this is the architecture, if this is the lens, how would markets take the input, insert it into this framework, what would probably come out? So for me, the price action itself is a kind of dynamic recalibrating of the macro lens all the time.
I'm going to ask you one more follow-up. We're 45 minutes in, and I haven't gone simple by simple, but this is sometimes you and I, we get into these sort of, I would call it philosophical discussions, which I enjoy. Hopefully the audience is enjoying as well, but I promise all of you want to see us go symbol by symbol. I will do that with the last 10 minutes of the show or so.
Sure.
When I hear you talk about risk, generally speaking, it's always sort of this, I can always tell you the time frame. You know, it's always sort of like day by day, week to week type of time frame. Whereas I've never heard you say, generally speaking, I think risk is heavy this week, or I'm going to take with short-term capital, I'm going to bet against the market, or I'm going to go long dollars, or I'm going to bet against the NASDAQ. However, stock XYZ or commodity XYZ is so bombed out at this level, I think there's good risk reward over a longer term. What I'm saying is, I'm managing, for me and my family, different time frames of capital. And that can be confusing for an audience, for me to say, I've got these miners, or I've got FCX, or I've got these drone stocks or uranium stocks, because I think about these long-term potentials over a 20-year investing horizon, 5, 10, 20 years. And these things are cheap. I don't know what they're going to do in the next 2 weeks, but they're cheap enough for me to start nibbling. Also, this is what I'm doing on my portfolio over the top in terms of short-term risk. That's how I think. That's how I talk. It can be confusing, I think, for the audience, but I think most people have gotten how I do it by now. I don't hear you talk in multiple time frames. Why is that? Is that for to make it simple content to consume? Or is that because you are just generally, you're trading all your capital in one way?
I'm definitely not. I have a diversity of ways that I do it. And it's very similar to what you're talking about. So I have what I would bucket out as essentially three buckets. One is a passive bucket where I'm not hands-on. I have capital there. It's basically a version of optimized beta. And that's sort of the 30-year buy and hold positive drift idea. I have a second bucket that is what you're talking about. Things that I think are kind of generational opportunities, cyclical opportunities, kind of big swing ideas over 5-10 years. But that's not active trading. So what I usually talk about in this context is tactical active participation in markets. And there, my time horizon can be months if I get the right idea. In fact, because I have a macro kind of view on things, my ideal position, like the trades where I tend to make my money, they tend to run 4 weeks, 6 weeks. Whereas the trades where I lose money, I try to cut off, on average, 1.5 weeks, 2 weeks, maybe. And I'm not cutting them off because they've elapsed that time. That's just how it tends to look. Once I look back at the numbers, I go, well, my losers have an average holding period of 1 to 2 weeks. My winners have an average holding period of 4 to 6 weeks. So that's the way I approach the sort of more tactical, hands-on, like I want to be a trader of the euro or the dollar or NASDAQ or S&P now. That's sort of the hands-on part of it. But I absolutely do the same thing. There's just not much to say, let's say, about cannabis. I've owned cannabis ETFs forever. They've done nothing but sink. Anytime I see anything that looks like an opportunity to add some, I add some. I have a
they sink except in election year. You ever notice that? In election and midterm years, for the last 4 years, you know, surprisingly, there's like always some rumors about, you know.
Well, the Biden administration seems to actually be trying to do something. But I
think
it's
a matter of trying, bro. There's not the political capital. 70% of Americans.
I think there is. I think there is. But that's me. I'm not in the room. But they're getting closer than anybody I've heard until now. But of course, Marco Papich wrote a book on this called Geopolitical Alpha, and he talks about this idea called the median voter. and says that politics reflects the opinion of the median voter, even in non-democratic societies, because you can only prevent the pitchforks from so long. So you still have to respond to the median voter. The median voter on the cannabis issue has obviously moved tremendously in the past, let's call it 10, 20 years. So here's an idea where I'm going to accumulate and accumulate and accumulate and accumulate. And one day, it's going to look like Amazon stock. But, and until that day, I have it. It's unleveraged. It's sitting there. It's a thematic idea. Am I actively going in and out of MJ or MSOS? Good Lord, no.
All right, man, let's go simple by simple. By the way, I'm in a country right now where the penalty for smuggling in marijuana or distributing marijuana is death. It's an automatic death sentence.
Smelling the fumes from across the street might catch you into some trouble.
By hanging, by the way. Like, it's no peaceful, like, lethal injection either.
No.
Old school with it.
They want you to know. It's funny, when I first arrived in Bali, which was obviously not in Singapore.
Close enough. Not Indonesia. But
yeah, Indonesia. So I arrive in Bali and there's a poster that in the airport that says it's death penalty for anybody that brings drugs into Bali. Yeah. And so I take a picture of the poster and then notice the next poster right under it is no pictures.
My favorite sign here, is the no trespassing sign. I forget what the no trespassing sign is in the States, but here, it's like two stick figures, right? The first stick figure's got his hands up like this, and the second figure is an authority figure behind the person who's got his hands up, with like an automatic rifle.
Nice.
And bullets coming out of it. There's bullets going out.
So you trespass, we shoot you.
It's hilarious for so many reasons, because it's so aggressive, but it's also like whoever that was had already surrendered and still being shot in the back. All right, let's keep going, man. Let's talk bonds for just a second. We talked last week about them. We've only got a couple minutes, so actually we're going to do this rapid fire.
Let's go.
Give me your thoughts on the twos and the tens. Do any of the levels there or the price action look interesting to you? They've been basically flat, man. They haven't gone
in
the last week and a half.
Yeah, in a word, no. I mean, there's nothing that's going on here that gets me excited. So I thought that maybe last week there were some signs of bottoming. We've not overturned those signs, but we've also not actually started the bottom. And so this is basically a flat line. Nothing's going on. Get me north of 108 on ZN, maybe to like 108.20, something like that. Mm. I get more interested because at least, again, the price action is telling me markets want to actually do something. But here, who knows? There's nothing here that to me says there is an active directional thing that's occurring with follow through potential. Either way.
I am, just for the record, you're more than welcome, everybody listening or watching on demand. I'm along the 10 years, which it's totally non-consensus right now. I think a lot of people think that the 10 years is going to continue to drift lower, meaning rates are going to go higher. And that 5%, you know, we've got a date of destiny to that 5% level in the 10-year. We're currently at like 4.6%. In fairness, though, for people, I've had this position on for the last 2 weeks. And what I do is I buy the weekly, like, kind of at the money or slightly out of the money puts as a hedge to the position, which lets me sleep at night to hold the long futures here. And a lot of people say, well, that's just a synthetic long call. Why don't you just get long calls? And I would say, stay out of my business.
No, I'm with you, actually. I think there's a greater chance we bounce than crack lower. But I'm not willing to put my money where my mouth is here until the price action actually shows me something.
Yeah, my idea behind that is If they are positively correlated, then I've got a long stock portfolio. And if the 10-year goes lower, what has been the typical correlation is stocks kind of have drifted higher, even though that's sort of counterintuitive, but that has been what has happened lately. Talk to me, my friend, about currencies. This is like, obviously it's your specialty, especially when compared to myself. So help me understand how you're thinking about dollars here.
Well, so last week, obviously the dollar had a big run. I was in it. It was great because stocks were falling and we had this kind of liquidation, and the money as ever went to cash. And what's the cash of choice in a liquidation? It's the most liquid form of cash. It's dollars. So I'm looking at this and going, well, if I think that stock markets are now biased lower, then I think the dollar is biased higher. And the reason I think it's biased higher is, and stocks are biased lower, is the same reason. The Fed is going to out-hawk all the other central banks here. That's not good for risk appetite and bad for stocks. It is, however, good for the US dollar. I'm out of it now. Again, at the start of the week, I cleared out of almost everything. I took a little bit of a flyer being long the Canadian dollar as a little counter trend thing. I took a little bit of money out of it. I got out today, anticipating GDP tomorrow. And so I'm looking at this here and thinking, I want to be short 6E. I want to be short 6B, the British pound. I probably want to be short 6C, the Canadian dollar. I just need for the price action to actually show me that it's go time. So at this point, for example, if I'm looking at 6E, it's right at critical resistance here. It's testing the underside of the range that it had since December. It cracked it last week. It's retesting it now right around like 107.15, 107.20 or so. I see it turn back from this and get, let's say, back under 106.80 or something like that. I'm short. I look at 6B and it's a similar story. I had a great run being short this from about 126.30. I see it now coming back into retest 125, 125.30. I see it lose here and get back under, let's say, 124 and change, having tested 125 and come back, I'm short. So I want to be long dollars. I just want the market to tell me when.
What does that mean? There's an implicit view of what that means for commodities.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. I want to ask the question explicitly. Do you have risk deployed on the downside for any of these dollar-based commodities, or you'd rather deploy your risk in dollars but not necessarily have a position, let's say, in the downside of crude oil, the downside of gold, the downside of silver, downside of copper? Like, how are you playing all those commodities?
Silver and copper are a little bit too volatile for me most of the time for the kind of approach that I take. They're a little too jumpy. So I usually stay away unless something really kind of screams. And I haven't touched that yet.
Crude oil. I've gone out with you. You're an absolute animal. You mean to tell me high beta silver is too much risk for you? Absolutely not. I've seen you knock them back with the best of them, and you're a rapper in your spare time. You mean to tell me you can't handle the beta of silver? Give me a break. Yo.
Silver, so my trading hat and my scotch consumption hat are different hats. They're different hats. So I look at this and I say, okay, as a manager of my portfolio, silver is usually a little extra for me. Although I am getting a little curious here, on gold, we've talked about this. That's, if I was going to take a bet on the metals, it would be there.
Long or short?
I want to be long a pullback rather than short here. I think that there is a pullback here, maybe back down to 2100 or something like this. as we get into the gravitational pull of next week's Fed meeting and then into the June Fed meeting. I think the longer term story here is China accumulating a ridiculous amount of gold reserves. And by my back of the envelope math, that's not a thing that goes away until maybe early next year. So I think, and because the way gold's behaving has nothing to do with all of its normal catalysts at all. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's decoupled from the trend in GLD ETF holdings for the first time in like over a decade. So something's different is going on. And the only thing that I can find is China is absolutely plowing reserves into gold. So, I mean, the pace is nuts. 11% year on year is the growth rate in Chinese gold reserves. It's, I mean, they're buying as much as they can. So I think you get a pullback here as they kind of take their foot off the gas a little recently. And it, or at least that's what it looks like looking at the price action. It's very difficult for gold to ignore a hawkish Fed, even episodically, for a week or two. So you get slammed back down, and that's where I want to be a buyer. I'm getting interested and tempted to maybe sell some here, but I'm trying to talk myself out of it and try to say, you know what, just buy dollars. Don't fight the PBOC. Mm-hmm. And on crude is this weird animal here where I can't find you a good reason why it should be up here for any of the geopolitical reasons or the supply demand reasons. All of it is kind of hypothetical fear of fear itself. Like,
yeah,
there's
two. Wasn't there a decent draw in inventories today?
Yeah, but that's a weekly number. I mean, like, we've been rallying in crude since the beginning of the year, and the country is awash in supply. The spread between WTI and the European benchmark, Brent crude, is pinned around the $5 level where it's been since 2013. What disruption? There is no disruption. Supply to Europe is fine. The Red Sea thing is not doing anything. The Ukraine thing isn't doing anything. Europe has oil. So why is it up here? Is it up here because the global economy is accelerating? No. So why is it up here? It seems to be up here because of, or at least the only thing I can come up with, is the hypothetical idea that with these two wars in critical choke points for crude, something could happen. So we're going to put a premium on if something. And so it's just a weird macro story that doesn't lend itself in my mind to kind of to being assessed in a reasonable way. So I'm keeping my hands off this now. If I want general exposure, I'll buy some dollars. I'll short some Canadian dollars and sort of keep it like that until gold gives me something to do. On the long side, provided I can talk my, I can continue to talk myself out of selling some, which I hope I can.
Yeah, I happened to get lucky on that gold turn. You know, I'd probably been short gold, the commodity, not the miners, probably that week, a week early. So I caught the turn the day when metals were weak, silver specifically. I think we're down maybe 0.75%, maybe 0.5%. I tried to get some out of the money puts in silver. And you know, they always say, do you want the penny or do you want the position?
Right.
I dicked around later that day, silver's down 4%. It has not come back. And I was just like kicking myself. I'm making money on the gold thing, or at least hedging the minor risk. But it's just like, that would have been, I'd be buying you steak right now if I you know, went for the position instead of the penny. Ilya, it's always fun, my friends. you know, last week we had a lot of fun and we decided the format, like to go back and forth like this is interesting, especially in these types of markets where the market kind of was in a range until after the close where Meta came out. There's not much new, you know, news flow to really talk about, or not much changing dynamics in macro on a day-to-day basis. So this was a bit of a fun discussion. If people want more from you, Elliot, tell them where they can go.
As ever, Macro Money is a show that I do where I nerd out on this stuff every Monday through Thursday. Right before that is Overtime with myself, Chris, and Dylan Radigan, where we look at the Wall Street close and try to figure out what it might mean and why we got to where we got. I'm obviously here now on Wednesdays, which I love. I love having these big philosophical conversations. I think it's great. I'm on with Chris for Futures Power Hour on Fridays. It's usually a good time to look at U.S. Data that might have come out that morning, especially at NFP. I'm on, we're both on with Tom and Pete and the gang for First Call on Sundays. We're looking at the APAC Open, my favorite time of the week where I think all of my big ideas for the week. I'm writing for tastylive.com's news and insights section. I'm opining sporadically on the former Twitter machine at Ilya Spivak.
My man, it's always a pleasure. These conversations are always fun and enlightening from my perspective. I appreciate both your time as well as you sharing your knowledge. I look forward to next week. For everybody out there, do us a favor before you get out of here. Hit the like button, subscribe to the channel if you're not already. Leave us a comment on your way out of the door on the video. Tell us what you think the rest of the earnings season or how it's going to shape up, whether you're long or short, bullish or bearish, and over what time frame. I promise you, we do read them. And we appreciate all the comments. Until next time, I've been Victor Jones.
I'm Ilya Spivak.
It's another episode of The Price of Truth. Until next time, peace.
The content of this podcast is created, produced, and provided solely by Tasty Life, Inc. and does not represent the direct views or opinions of any of its affiliated companies. This content is for informational and educational purposes only. It is not, nor is it intended to be trading or investment advice or a recommendation that any security, futures contract, digital asset, other product, transaction, or investment strategy is suitable for any person. Trading securities, futures products, and digital assets involve risk and may result in a loss greater than the original amount invested. Tastylive, Inc., through its content, financial programming, or otherwise, does not provide investment or financial advice or make investment recommendations. The information provided may not be appropriate for all investors and is provided without respect to individual investor financial sophistication, financial situation, investing time horizon, or risk tolerance. Tastylive, Inc. is not a licensed financial advisor, registered investment advisor, registered broker-dealer, or registered introducing broker.